Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Snafu. Please visit our website and our Patreon page for bonus content such as pictures of the characters, maps of the airfield, Q&A episodes, and much, much more. This podcast contains explicit content that may not be suitable for some audience members. Listener's discretion is advised. Jack awoke to the sounds of his hut door opening. Looking up, he watched as the shadow-like figure entered in and made its way over to his bunk. Before he knew it, the sergeant lit a cigarette and placed it in Jack's mouth, and then turned on his lamp, stating, "Lieutenant Miller, you've been selected to fly a mission today. Breakfast at 0300, briefing at 0400, and takeoff is scheduled for 0530. Good luck today, Lieutenant." As Jack watched the sergeant exit the hut, he looked over at Brolin and the rest of Hailing Mary and wondered why they weren't selected to fly today. Getting up and getting ready, Jack also began to wonder who he was going to be flying with today. He knew that Loda Bull was still in the hangar and was being repaired, and since there were a lot of replacement crews that had just arrived in Thurlow over the last 2 weeks, he more than likely was going to have to fly with another crew. As Jack finished getting ready, O'Brien arose from his bed and wished Jack a successful and safe mission, much to Jack's appreciation. Soon, Jack was out the door and headed towards the mess hall. At the mess hall, Jack was leaving the food line and was walking to the dining hall, looking for someone he could sit with. Capturing his eyes almost immediately was Tango and his crew, which were sitting at a table just next to the opening of the food line. Tango, spotting Jack at the same time Jack spotted him, offered Jack a seat at his table. Jack agreed and proceeded to sit at the end of the table, with Tango sitting next to him and Bill Davis sitting across from him.
"Did you and the rest of your crew get selected today?"
Bill Davies asked.
"I have no idea. I was going to scarf this down and then go looking for them in the enlisted men's mess hall,"
Jack replied.
"No need to rush. You'll find out when you go to the briefing hut. Sit, drink some coffee, wake up some,"
instructed Tango.
"Yes, father," Jack fired back with a slight grin on his face. "See, there he is,"
Tango said, patting Jack on his back and sliding his cup of coffee over next to him.
Who else was selected to fly today? From our squadron, that is," asked Jack. "Well, I saw Leslie and Moose in the mess line when I first walked in. I don't know where they're sitting,"
answered Tango.
"I also saw your pilot's buddy, Burke, I think his name is. I saw him and his crew. They're over by the fireplace,"
mentioned Tango's navigator.
"Is that so?"
Jack said, turning around to see Burke and his crew talking and joking around over by the fireplace. Just then, Jack heard the familiar voice call out to him.
"Hey, hey!"
It was Hillhouse, and soon, Benson joined him. Hillhouse proceeded to explain that he and Benson were selected to fly today's mission as well, so Jack knew that he wouldn't be flying with Hillhouse and dropping deuces, or with Tango and Bad Penny, or with Burke and his crew of Stormy Night. Who the hell was he going to be flying with? He thought to himself. Jack would get his answer when he arrived at the briefing hut. Looking at the flight roster, Jack saw that he was to fly as the pilot of a rookie crew whose co-pilot was Second Lieutenant Paul Ayers. Jack had no idea who this Lieutenant Ayers was or what he looked like, so he proceeded to ask Tango if he knew him. Tango shook his head, but his bombardier nodded his head and pointed him out to Jack. Sitting towards the front of the room was a man Jack was supposed to be flying with. Before he made his way over to Paul, Jack looked down at the paper and saw that nobody from Loda Bull was scheduled to fly today. Just him. Feeling somewhat relieved, Jack then walked over to Paul and introduced himself. Painted on the back of Paul's bomber jacket were the words "Tailwinders," and below the words was a painted picture of a woman's butt exposed under a lifted red skirt. The red was vibrant and hard to miss.
Nice artwork,
Jack introduced as he took a seat next to Paul.
What?
Paul asked.
Your bomber jacket. Your nose art. That's nice.
Oh yeah, we haven't gotten it painted on our plane yet. Unfortunately, the guy who painted our jackets, he got shot down on the last mission to Brunswick.
Is that so?
Jack asked, refraining from finding out who it was.
Yep. I heard you led that formation on that mission.
Wait, you know who I am? Jack asked as he pulled his body back away from Paul.
Of course I do. You and your pilot, well, I guess our squadron commander, are both talk amongst the new guys.
Well, what are they saying? Jack asked.
It's nothing,
Paul sheepishly replied.
No, tell me. I won't relay it to Captain Backus.
Okay. Well, the scuttlebutt is that your pilot is, kind of a lunatic, you know? Loose in the head.
Jack's heart began to beat faster after hearing this.
What do you mean, loose in the head?
Well, you'd have to be to go bomb a cover target.
I'm sorry, I've said too much, Paul exclaimed as his body language changed. Just then, the other three officers from Paul's crew arrived and sat on the opposite side of Paul. Both of these men introduced themselves to Jack, and Jack did the same, but noticed that the two men already acted like they knew who Jack was, only confirming what Paul had just told him. After a few minutes of awkward silence among Jack and the rookie crew, Jack decided to make casual small talk among him and Paul. He leaned back over to Paul and asked,
So, this is your first mission, yes?
Yes, sir.
Please don't call me, sir. How many practice missions have you flown?
Since we arrived in England?
Just one.
Just one?
Yeah, and to be honest, I wish I had more time to practice. I just started getting the hang of flying a 17.
Suddenly perplexed, Jack cocked his head over to Paul and said,
Wait, what do you mean?
Oh, sorry. Backstory. I was flying C-47s back in the States, and they transferred me to go to the 8th just about a week or so ago.
Wait, so you weren't trained on the B-17 before or after you were transferred?
No, sir. Lieutenant. I was only flying transport planes. That and training aircraft.
Jack couldn't believe what he was hearing. How in the world was he supposed to fly with someone who had only been flying the B-17 for less than a week? What the hell was the Army Air Corps doing?
But what kind of work did you do flying C-47s back in the States?
I flew mainly short transport routes from Mitchell Field in Milwaukee to my home base in Langley Field in Virginia.
Just as Jack was going to ask further questions, the room stood at attention as Colonel Poole entered in and walked down the aisle to the front of the stage. Once there, he went into his morning monologue, and Jack listened and waited for Colonel Poole to mention the Brunswick mission. But surprisingly, he didn't. Then, he signaled for the curtain to be pulled back, and once the map was revealed, the men groaned and moaned over the flight line. Colonel Poole announced the 300th was heading to bomb the Heinkel plant in Tours, France. Later, May 1st,
1944, United States Army Air Force Station 186, Thurlow, England, 0534. The boss stood by the control tower and watched the 20 B-17s make their way around the perimeter track and headed towards the west end of Runway 4. While the boss wasn't going to be leading the 300th today on their mission, he knew all about their mission. Tours, France was 150 miles south of the Normandy coast, and the overall mission would take a total of 5.5 hours to fly the 700 miles round trip, most of which would be spent over Nazi-occupied France. The 300th was set to fly in the high wing of the 3rd Group, with the 530th Squadron flying in the high squadron. A total of 6 groups were assigned to bomb the target today, meaning there was a total of 330-plus planes flying in the formation. The formation was to be escorted by a single squadron of P-51 Mustangs to and from the target, and the formation was expected to see little fighter opposition and mild to light flak. Overall, the boss was confident that the 300th, and more specifically, the 530th Squadron, would be successful in bombing the target and returning home victorious. Soon, the boss watched as the B-17s from the 528th Squadron, led by Major Elliot Gould, ran down the runway and lifted up into the air, followed by the 530th Squadron, which was led by the most experienced pilot in the 530th Squadron, Lieutenant Richard Leslie, and his crew of Bob McGee. Each bomber took off in order of their position in the formation. Bob McGee took off first, with Ronnie and the rest of Hellfire from above taking off behind them. Next on the runway was Hill House and the rest of Dropping Deuces, which was still being patched up moments before the engine started. Next was Burke in his plane Stormy Night, and Jack's friend Tango in Bad Penny. Finally, the last plane the 530th to take off was Tailwinders, flown by Jack. Inside the cockpit, Jack was sitting in the pilot seat and looked over at his very nervous and anxious co-pilot, and the two men then opened up the throttle and roared down the runway. As the brand new B-17 lifted off the ground, the boss then headed back to his office, as he would now count down the minutes until they came back. 3.5 hours later, the formation was approaching their third waypoint, which was 25,000 feet above the French village of Gaque. From where they were at, Jack was able to see Paris just nestled on the horizon. He always wanted to visit Paris with Marlene, and yet here he was, less than a 15-minute detour away from the romantic city itself. Jack knocked himself out of his daydream-like mindset, for he needed to focus. So far, the mission had been a quiet one. Only 3 planes in the entire formation had to abort the mission due to engine or equipment malfunctions, and no planes collided on assembly. Crossing over the Normandy coast was breathtaking, and there was almost not a speck of flak in the sky as they crossed over the coast and deep into France. Looking over at Paul, Jack saw that he was still nervous. Jack decided that he needed a break and gave the controls over to the nervous co-pilot in order to keep him productive. That's what the boss always did, at least, when Jack noticeably became anxious or nervous. Overall, Jack liked Paul. At first, Jack didn't know how to take him. He stood at only 5'6" tall, he had a stiff, athletic body build, and the most chiseled jawline of anyone Jack had ever seen or met before. It was almost as though he were some ancient Greek statue that came to life in 1944. Tailwinder's bombardier, the man behind the unique name and art for the plane, was a man by the name of Clay Chavis, a 5'8" Navajo who had the same temperament and demeanor of a German shepherd. During the entire briefing, he sat with his back straight, shoulders cocked back, and his eyes locked onto Captain Burnett as he ran through the mission briefing, and later, the target photos. Clay didn't say much, but he did seem to have a playful nature to him, which was a nice break from the serious tone of the rest of the crew. Tailwinder's navigator was a short, scrawny kid from Texas named Kevin McGuire. He was quiet, reserved, and was, for the most part, the most nervous one of the mission. Jack did what he could before the mission to calm him down, but it was of no use. The rest of the crew were all peach-faced 19 and 20-year-old kids. In fact, Jack was surprised at how alike they all looked. None of them seemed to stand out among their peers. They were all so uniform, like personality-lacking pawns destined to be used in war. Was that what Parnell was talking about? Was this how he was supposed to view the new members of his own crew? Before Jack could think about anything else, the call came in that the formation was slightly changing direction as they arrived at the third waypoint and were now headed towards the decision point, which was 65 miles southeast and just 30 miles east of Le Mans, France. Just as Jack was about to remind Paul to do an oxygen check, the call came over the intercom.
"We've got bandits, 6 o'clock low. I see a lot of them."
Jack was unsure who the call came from, but it didn't matter.
"What do you see? Can you make out the planes?"
Paul asked.
"I can't tell. They're headed by force, though,"
replied the gunner.
"Maybe they're friendlies,"
suggested another one of the gunners.
"Maybe, or maybe not. Wait. The escort fighters are going after them,"
called in Clay, as he and Jack watched their escorts dive towards the incoming attack. Over the next 40 seconds, Jack took back the controls of Tailwinders, and the formation began to tighten up. Then, before Jack knew it, the air was full of gunfire and hot metal being thrown around the sky. That's when the calls came in that Jack dreaded hearing.
"B-17 going down, 6 o'clock. Looks to be from Group 6. Oh, I see him. Oh, shit! We've got 110s! I see two engines!"
yelled at one of the gunners.
"No yelling. We can hear you fine,"
Jack thundered in.
"And we've got 190s! Look, it doesn't matter what they are if they're not being sent to hell. Focus on whatever fighter is within range and shoot at it,"
Jack corrected.
"110s are carrying rockets! B-17 going down! Oh, fuck! There's three! 17's going down right now!" "Enough with the yelling! Are the 110s in range?"
Jack asked.
"No, sir!" "Okay, then they're not your problem right now. Don't waste your ammo on them. Stick with the ones that you're closest to."
As Jack finished his sentence, he was cut off when a sudden flash appeared behind him from bullets being ripped into the cockpit.
Do you like war movies? Do they get your blood going? If so, I have the perfect podcast for you. This is not an affiliation. This isn't like we're sponsoring them, they're sponsoring us, so I got to mention them. This is just me strictly telling you about a podcast I love. The podcast is called Danger Close. It's a war film podcast where three hosts, a theater director, a movie critic, and a veteran, come together each week to talk about a different war movie. Guys, this is a fantastic podcast. If you want to get into war films on just more than just a surface level, this is perfect. The hosts are phenomenal. The research is impeccable, and the quality of it is just phenomenal. I can't recommend this enough. So if you guys enjoy podcasts, you want more podcasts to make your day go by faster at work, or you wanted something to listen to while you're cleaning house or trying to fall asleep or you're driving in the car, guys, this is a perfect podcast to listen to. Danger Close, check it out for yourself. If you do, go onto the discussion page on Facebook and tell them that Aaron from Cancer 34 Studios and Snafu Podcast sent you. Thank you guys so much. Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you, because you can. You see, by visiting our website, www.snafupod.net, you can find all kinds of amazing free, it's important, free resources to help you find out more about the 8th Air Force in World War II and about the B-17 Flying Fortress. Right now, you can take a virtual tour of two real B-17s like the ones depicted in Snafu. Also, you can find links to movies, documentaries, and free YouTube videos, and much, much, much more. All you have to do is visit www.snafupod.net and check it out for yourself. Now, back to the podcast.
A fire had broken out on the flight deck of Tailwinders. Several bullets struck the number 3 engine, and a couple bullets ripped through the cockpit. The top turret gunner jumped down from his turret and grabbed the nearest fire extinguisher and put out the fire. Meanwhile, Jack began looking over the flight controls, and he and the now robotic and stoic Paul ran through their checklist, making sure nothing was malfunctioning. So far, the number 3 engine was still working fine, and there seemed to be no additional damage done to the flight controls. Once the fire was put out, Jack ordered the top turret gunner to return to his turret. The gunner didn't hesitate, but followed Jack's command. As Jack looked over at his 2 o'clock position to check to see his distance between him and Burke's plane Stormy Knight's vertical stabilizer, he watched as the BF-110 zipped through the formation and headed down towards the front of the formation. As it did, the rear gunner on the 110 began sending shots in the direction of Tailwinders and Stormy Knight. Then, Jack was amazed to see 4 white lines leaving the fighter's wings. The 110 had fired 4 rockets towards the B-17s flying the group ahead of them. Before the rockets landed any hits, the 110 banked hard to the left and exploded when it began taking on dense amount of hits. In one fell swoop, 1 rocket struck the right wing of a B-17 flying the 92nd bombardment group, and the debris from the 110 flew right into the path of the 531st Squadron, and by some miracle, not a single B-17 collided with it. The B-17 that took a rocket to its wing had become broken up. It was now heading towards Earth with flames engulfing the fuselage. Within the next minute, the sounds of guns firing subsided and then came to a halt. A call came in that confirmed that the fighters were now leaving and that all but 1 190 had been shot down and none of the 110s were still flying. Jack took in a deep breath and gave the controls back to Paul, taking a moment to breathe. Back at base, the boss had entered Jack's hut, expecting to find the 2 new guys who had been assigned to the bull standing in there. Once he had entered in and closed the door behind them, he was pleased to see that not only were the 2 new guys in there, but Sheila was in there with them, talking to them. The moment Sheila saw the boss, his face fell, and he soon turned his back to him. "Good morning, Lieutenant Sheila," the boss called out, smiling while he looked at both Sal and Timothy.
"Good morning, Captain,"
Sheila responded.
"Well, I don't believe I've introduced myself. My sincerest apologies. I'm Captain Backus, your squadron commander for the 530th Squadron,"
the boss introduced while offering up his hand to the 2 gentlemen who were standing in the middle of the room. Sal shook it and said,
"It's nice to meet you. Lieutenant Sabatini. My friends call me Sal."
"Italian. Where are you from, Lieutenant?" the boss asked before going to shake Timothy's hand.
"Detroit."
"Detroit? Well, I'm from Youngstown. I would love to hear all about Detroit over a beer sometime. I've always wanted to see the Motor City." The boss now shook Timothy's hand and was immediately taken aback by Timothy's demeanor.
"Lieutenant Timothy Wigner, sir."
The boss didn't know why, but he instantly didn't like him. His inability to make eye contact for too long, and his caved-in shoulders and his nervous twitch of his nostrils was just annoying to him.
"Lieutenant, where are you from?"
"Florida, sir."
"Florida, you say? Nice sunny weather. I'm sure England is far from the warm and sunny springs you're used to. Are you my new navigator?"
"No, sir. I'm a bombardier,"
Timothy sheepishly said.
"Oh, you must be confused. I'm the navigator,"
Sal responded. The boss nodded his head with a smile still carved into his face.
"Good. Well, I was up all worried last night that the bull wasn't going to have the best bombardier navigator on board, but thank God he was one step ahead of me and took care of that worry."
The bull?" asked Timothy.
"Yes, that's the name of our plane. Load a Bull. The name was my idea, but anyways, I'll let you 2 get back to talking with Lieutenant Sheila here. He's a fine gentleman, one hell of a navigator himself. He's guided his crew through, how many missions have you flown, Sheila?"
the boss asked.
15,
responded Sheila.
15, geez, lucky man he is. Well, anyways, I'm off. You gentlemen take care of yourselves,"
said the boss as he began walking towards the door.
"No, thank you, Captain Backus,"
Sal replied.
"Oh, no. Thank you, Lieutenant,"
the boss said, opening up the door and proceeded to leave the hut. The moment he did, Sal turned to Sheila and said,
"He didn't seem that bad."
Oh, you'll see,
Sheila softly muttered under his breath.
It had been 10 minutes since the fighters left, and the call had just come in that the group was over the initial point and were now on the bombing run. Jack gave the controls over to Clay in his bomb sight and proceeded to look over to Paul and ask him,
"Are you okay?"
Paul nodded his head.
"Good,"
Jack responded, looking forward again at the French horizon. Within a minute or so, the dreadful sounds of flak began to appear. However, it wasn't as accurate or thick as Jack's previous missions had been, but that didn't stop the new crews from marveling at the black puffs of smoke. That was, until one came too close. A flak burst went off about 25 feet away from the waste compartment, violently bumping the plane to the left.
"Jesus Christ, that was close!"
said one of the gunners after hearing the sounds of shrapnel bouncing off the underside of the waste compartment. Jack was now growing irritated with the new crew. "They think this is bad? Wait until they see the flak fields above Frankfurt, Brunswick, Hamburg, or Berlin," he thought to himself. Was Jack still fearful? Sure he was. Flak still posed a threat, regardless of how accurate or thick it was.
"I'm 30 seconds to target,"
Clay called in over the intercom. It was then that Jack realized that he never heard the call for the bomb doors to be open. Looking at the bomb door light on the control panel, he didn't see the light lit up. Looking behind him, he saw that there was no sunlight shining through the bomb bay.
"Call up the bombardier. Did you open the bomb bay?"
After a quick pause, Clay sheepishly replied over the intercom.
"Bomb bay door is opening."
And that's when Jack looked back and saw the bomb doors were in fact opening now. Paul shot a glance over to Jack that spoke what Jack was already feeling. The poor bombardier was so nervous that he forgot to open the goddamn bomb bay doors, Jack thought to himself. Soon, that's when Clay announced that the bombs were now releasing. After the plane lifted up from their weight change and closed the bomb bay doors, that's when the formation then changed its course and headed to the rally point. The boss entered into Colonel Poole's office back at High Brass Hall, and as the corporal who escorted him in closed the door behind him, Colonel Poole responded,
"I'm surprised you're not up there flying your first mission as a squadron commander. You must trust Lieutenant Leslie."
"I do. He's seen more action than anybody else flying that mission today, sir. He's a good man and he has a good crew."
"Confidence. I like that. Captain Dearborn will be proud to see you now. What can I do for you?"
The boss approached Colonel Poole's desk and began his proposal.
"Well, sir, it's in regards to the two replacements that were assigned to my crew."
"Your crew?" Colonel Poole questioned as he walked over to his window that overlooked the airfield.
My old crew, I mean."
"Okay, go on."
"Well, I just got done meeting with Lieutenant Salbatini and Lieutenant Winger. I gotta say, sir, I have some concerns."
"Concerns? What kinds of concerns?"
"Well, more so with Lieutenant Winger, the bombardier. I looked over his file. He scored a 90% on his bombardier training exam back in the States. Now, as you've said in the past, I get the most out of my crew, my old crew, I mean, by setting the expectations as high as I can and holding them to those expectations. And I have to be honest, sir, I don't think Lieutenant Winger is the, what do you call it, the right stuff."
Colonel Poole took in a deep breath and turned to look at the boss. And after leaving another pregnant pause, he said,
"Right stuff, huh?"
"Yes, sir."
"What is the right stuff, Captain?"
The boss was surprised by the question and took a second to gather his thoughts. Before he could respond, Colonel Poole interjected,
"Captain, I have seen a lot of squadron commanders come and go. The hardest part for all of them is transitioning from leading a crew to leading a whole squadron. This lieutenant, what am I supposed to do with him? Transfer him to another crew? Well, I don't know if you thought about this, but if I do that, then whatever problem you think he's going to cause with his incompetence, because he scored a 90% on his on his bombardier exam. It's just going to happen to another crew in your squadron. I'm sure this lieutenant is a fine bombardier and will do his job to the best of his ability. If your doubts are as valid as you say they are, then I suggest you run a couple practice missions with him from now until he goes on his first raid. That's what I would do.
Yes, sir, exhaled the boss.
Now, is there anything else I can do for you, Captain?
No, sir.
Okay, well, then you are dismissed.
Thank you, sir, the boss said before he casually left Colonel Poole's office. The formation was 25,000 feet above the French village of Courneuville-sur-Irwin, about 10 miles west of the city of Chartres, France. The fourth waypoint was just on the horizon, and soon, the formation would move towards the French coast, where they would arrive at their fifth waypoint. The intercom was silent on their flight from the target. None of the men talked. Jack had to remind Paul two times to call for oxygen checks, and was getting more agitated as the day progressed. Jack couldn't help but think back to his first mission. While his crew made the same mistakes, such as yelling over the intercom and being trigger-happy, he still felt that they had handled Berlin better than these guys had handled it so far with the mild mission. Maybe the boss's leadership was more effective than he had given him credit for. Before Jack could ponder any more, the call came in over the intercom.
We've got bandits coming in at 6 o'clock low. Well, how many do you see?
Asked Paul.
I don't know. Maybe 6. They're coming in faster,
replied the gunner. Jack took this moment to give some encouragement to the men by saying,
All right, men. You survived the first attack. Now you can survive this. Keep yourselves together. Keep the intercom clear. Don't yell. We don't need you to yell. Make your shots count on this attack. Hopefully this is our last appointment we'll have with the crowds today. All right,
responded one gunner. Other calls followed. Within minutes, the attacks began.
I count 3 squadrons of 109s coming in, 6 o'clock low. Attacking groups 5 and 6 now. Don't forget to call out any down 17s,
Paul added.
30 seconds later, it was reported that a B-17 had taken heavy damage and was now falling behind. Then the call came in that the group of 109s were headed down towards the middle of the formation where the 300th was flying. The sounds of gunfire sounded all around Jack, and soon he saw the 109 zip past them on their left side with an eager P-51 following behind it. The sounds of the guns in the nose were following suit.
109 coming in, 5 o'clock high, watch it, Duncan. I see him. 109 coming around, 8 o'clock low. You see him, Dennis? Yeah, I see him.
As the calls kept coming in, Jack saw the formation bank slightly to the left as they had reached their waypoint. Moments later, the plane shuddered and screams began sounding into the intercom.
He's hit! McCoy's hit! Kevin, go check it out,
Paul commanded. Jack, assuming Kevin was the radio operator, refrained to say anything. Less than 40 seconds later, the call came in.
There's blood everywhere. God. Listen, keep focus on those fighters. Let Kevin handle it,
Jack commanded.
Do you need me to go back there?
Paul asked.
No, I need you to stay here. I may need you,
Jack thundered over to Paul. Paul obliged. As the flight continued, Jack and the others waited to hear back from Kevin. Looking over at Paul, he could see that Paul looked disturbed and worried. Knowing what that felt like, Jack took in a deep breath and said,
All right, go back and check out on him, but I need you back ASAP. Do you hear me?
Paul nodded his head with gratitude and proceeded to head back to the waste compartment. As the minutes passed by, Jack felt his heart thumping harder and harder. Just as Jack thought that he had made a mistake, Paul returned with blood on his hands. After Paul got back in his seat, Jack asked,
How is he?
With pure terror and fear in his eyes, Paul replied,
He took a hit to his right arm. He's losing a lot of blood. Alright, apply pressure. Use your scarf to wrap around the wound,
Jack commanded over the intercom.
He can't. The wound is... It's big,
replied one of the gunners.
Well, how big?
Jack asked. That's when Jack saw Paul pull down his mask, and he yelled over at Jack that the gunner's right arm was nearly detached from his shoulder, and he took substantial damage to his right side. Jack, knowing that a wound like that could be fatal, thundered over the intercom.
All right, do what you can. Give him some morphine. Calm him down. He doesn't need to lose any more blood. Yeah, he's got the first aid kit out now,
responded the other waste gunner. Jack wondered if the advice he gave would end up making a difference. Unfortunately, what he heard back was that the morphine was missing from the first aid kit. Not knowing how this was possible, he remembered Coca and O'Brien mentioning that morphine was going missing from first aid kits, and he forgot to check theirs before taking off.
What are we to do?
Asked one of the gunners. Jack was paralyzed with fear and infected with indecision. He wasn't ready for this. He wasn't ready to deal or handle such things. Looking to Paul, he was only driven further into an anxiety-riddled, frantic state. Seeing the horror and fear in Paul's naturally stoic eyes sent blood-chilling shocks throughout his body.
What are we to do?
Asked an airman. Jack, realizing that he had to act, pushed through his panic state and began churning out orders.
Kevin, position him where he will be the most comfortable. Stay with him. The rest of you, keep watch over those fighters. There is no need to put the rest of your crew in jeopardy. Yes, sir,
called in one of the gunners. Jack expected to feel some sort of relief, but he didn't. He didn't know the true extent of the wound, but he knew it was going to be another hour until they made it back to England, and it would be another hour and a half until they realistically landed and could get him to a hospital. Jack knew that the chances of the airman living was low. Now, Jack wondered if the other airmen knew that.
Do you want to get more out of Snafu? Well, guess what? There's good news for you because you can. You see, by becoming a supporter of the podcast, you will receive bonus content such as pictures and profiles of all the characters mentioned in today's episode, pictures and maps of the airfield and surrounding areas, as well as formation breakdowns of past, present, and future missions, and Q&A episodes. There is so much for you to gain by donating $3 or $10 to help support the podcast. If you would like to be a part of Snafu each week, please visit our Patreon page. The link for that's down in the show notes. Any support goes a long way in helping the podcast to continue. In fact, to give a shout out to those who are supporting this podcast, we want to thank Fernando, Reinhold, Benita, Kyle, and Cedric. Thank you guys so much for all your support and your helping this podcast to continue. Your contribution is making a huge difference. Now, back to the podcast.
The boss was standing by the control tower as the formation was arriving above Thurlow and were beginning their circling pattern. By his count, every single bomber made it back, not a single plane called in for an emergency landing. A good sign. One by one, each B-17 came into land, starting with the 528th Squadron, and then the 530th Squadron, and then finally the 530th Squadron. As each plane taxied back to their hard stands, the ground's crewmen and other airmen gathered around the perimeter track and cheered each bomber as it went by, celebrating the men being another mission closer to going home. After close to 40 minutes of circling the airfield, it was Tailwinder's turn to land. Jack made a hard landing, much to the embarrassment of the boss. The plane bounced heavily, almost crashing nose first. However, Jack was able to recover the landing and wrestled the bomber back onto the tarmac and came to a grinding halt close to the end of the runway. The B-17 then turned to head back towards the 530th Squadron hardstands, and that's when the boss got a true sense for what Jack's experience on the mission had entailed. The boss instantly noticed the bullet marks going through the cockpit and the fire damage done to the bullet hole riddled plexiglass cockpit rear window. He also noticed four small flak holes in the right wing, bullet holes in the number 3 engine, and a string of holes going right through the right side waste compartment opening. The boss watched as Tailwinders parked at its hardstand, and it was only a matter of time before airmen from the 530th Squadron began walking and driving towards the boss on their way to the debriefing hut. One of the officers who chose to walk was Burke from Stormy Night.
Burke, how'd it go today?
Asked the boss.
It went pretty well, I'd say. Only 2 fighter attacks. Escorts did a number on them. Had a close encounter with the 110 that was too close for comfort. But other than that, skies were pretty clear, and my tail gunner got himself a down Jerry. Well, that's awesome. Good for him. How did Jack do? I didn't hear any complaints. Sounded like he stayed right on my tail and kept in tight formation. However, I think he lost a guy. What do you mean? Well, my flight engineer watched Tailwinders take hits to his waste compartment. Yeah, I saw the damage, interrupted the boss. Well, we never saw that gunner move his gun or fire after that, so... And since they didn't shoot a red flare off, I assume he didn't make it. The boss thanked Burke for the information, and then told him to get going with the rest of his crew to the debriefing hut. The boss turned around and from afar watched as Jack helped carry out what looked like a body out of the waste compartment door and setting it down on the tarmac. The look of familiar sadness on the faces of other crew members confirmed his suspicions, and soon Jack and the rest of Tailwinders hopped onto a passing troop truck and made their way to the debriefing hut. About a half hour later, the boss was standing outside the debriefing hut, waiting for Jack. The boss had learned the gunner of Tailwinders was the only casualty the 300th had suffered on the mission to Tours, France. The boss began imagining how Jack handled being the chief of his own crew today. He wondered how he was going to handle telling the pilot in chief of Tailwinders that a crew member of his died while being under Jack's care and leadership. He remembered how traumatic it was to tell Texas that his navigator had died while flying with his crew. He also remembered being so filled with embarrassment and anger that he lashed out at Rosie for allowing it to happen. He also remembered how critical and angry Jack was at the boss when he overreacted. Maybe Jack will finally know and understand the reasons for why he does what he does. Maybe now he will finally understand the enormous pressures that come with being the chief of a crew on a mission. And with that new knowledge and understanding, maybe Jack would come to respect and have appreciation for the boss now. He hoped that this would be a wake-up call for Jack, causing him to take a good hard look at his inexperience handling a crew on his own, and would be a good lesson in him taking ownership and responsibility for both the good and bad elements of leading a crew of 9 through flak and fire-infested enemy skies. As the boss pondered this some more, he saw Ronnie exit the debriefing hut along with the rest of his crew. Ronnie, how'd it go today?
Asked the boss.
Ronnie took in a deep breath and said, Well, it wasn't the best mission I've flown, and it wasn't the worst one I've flown. I heard some of what happened.
The boss awkwardly responded.
Oh yeah, well, you know, it's over and done with now. Another yellow bomb could be added to my ledger. I'm headed to visit Mickey and then getting myself a goddamn drink.
Ronnie said, walking away from the boss, his hands nervously fidgeting with the officer's hat that he was holding in his hands.
By the way, how is Mickey? I don't know, why don't you go visit him and find out for yourself?
Ronnie said before he began talking to an enlisted man from his crew that he was walking with. The boss took in a deep breath, and just as he exhaled, he saw the hut door open again, and Jack came walking out with the rest of Tailwinders.
Hey, Jack,
said the boss.
Captain Backus,
muttered a visibly tired and worn out Jack.
Where are you headed?
Asked the boss. Why do you ask?
I was just wondering. Hey, Jack!
The boss said, after he stopped walking to say something personal to Jack, only to see him continue walking.
Yes, sir?
Jack asked.
You don't have to keep formalities today, Jack. I've heard you had a tough one today. Oh, so now we're buddies again?
Jack asked.
Okay, I've been a bit overbearing, I know. I'll admit to that, but I think you can come to understand why now. Why is that?
Asked Jack with a look of annoyance on his face.
Well, because you got to stand in my shoes today. You got to be the chief of your own crew.
I did.
Right, so, look, I heard what happened to you and the crew you flew with today. I just wanted to say I'm sorry.
Jack paused,
processing the boss's apology and began wondering if he was really sincere. He barely shed a tear for his own crew members being butchered and killed. Why would he be bent over about some gunner who he didn't know or didn't even know his name getting killed?
Jack?
Asked the boss. Jack snapped out of his moment of thinking and stared back at the boss and asked,
Did you mail the letter yet?
The boss, being rather offended at Jack's sudden change in conversation, asked,
Rosie's letter? Yeah. Did you mail it?
I haven't. I'll mail it first thing in the morning.
Okay. Well, have you visited Mills and the rest of Lota Bull?
The boss was now starting to get really offended by Jack's line of questioning.
Why do you ask?
Asked the boss.
What about Mickey? Have you visited him yet?
Oh, okay. You're still mad at me. It looks like you didn't learn a single thing today, Jack. And what a shame. You know, because to be honest with you, I was going to put you in charge of the bull and bump you up to the position of pilot, but I guess I'll have to find someone else to do the job since you keep on resenting me and living in the past.
Jack knew the boss wasn't truly sorry for what happened to the crew of Tailwinders today. There was nothing behind the boss's eyes except for self-aggrandizement and a swollen and hurt ego. Jack cracked a smile and replied,
Whoever you choose to fill in that pilot seat, I'm sure we'll do a better job than both you and I ever could.
As Jack turned around and walked away, the boss was once again filled with rage. Wanting to make an example out of Jack, he knew that Colonel Poole would think lowly of him for punishing his old co-pilot for insubordination, especially since he was so new to his position and it had only been a few days since his reckless stunt. Making a move on Jack could be seen as a bit heavy-handed.
Besides,
what Jack said was false, the boss thought to himself. He had been very busy the last few days and hadn't had time to mail Rosie's letter. He also was too busy getting his affairs in order. You know, with him becoming a squadron commander and all, he simply didn't have the time to visit Mills or Mickey in the hospital. They all understood that, right? It didn't matter. The boss was going to prove Jack wrong. He would do a quick round of checking up on those closest to him, and then make rounds checking on all the squadrons in the 530th Squadron. The first person on his list was Mickey. So, doing an about-face, the boss began heading upwards towards the base hospital. Upon entering in the hospital, the boss couldn't help but relive the moments he found out that Rosie had died. Walking past the entrance where he heard such news was like walking through a field of sadness. The lighting, the smells, and the sounds all resembled the moment that he and Jack discovered Rosie was forever gone. But pushing past those feelings, the boss arrived where Mickey was laying. He was surprised to see that Mickey was sound asleep. Mickey's right arm had been amputated above the elbow since his first incision had got infected, and they had to remove more of his arm to stop it from spreading. His lower part of his body was under his bedsheets, but the boss knew all too well that they had taken more from his leg, again from infection. Mickey's chest was still wrapped up, and his breathing looked to be normal. The boss didn't know if he should leave and come back a different day, or if he should wait until Mickey woke up. Looking around, he saw Dr. Dick, as he was known, approaching the corner of the hospital where Mickey's bed was located. The boss then approached the doctor and asked him if Mickey was going to be waking up soon. Dr. Dick, staying true to his name, shrugged his shoulders and said he didn't know in an agitated manner. Walking over to another patient's bed across from Mickey, Dr. Dick then began looking over the patient's chart. The boss followed him there.
I mean, is he going to be waking up soon?
For what? Asked Dr. Dick.
I don't know. More meds? Using the bathroom? Anything? Why? Are you offering to help wipe his ass and clean out his bedpan?
The boss was shocked that the doctor would dare be so offensive to an officer. Not just any officer. A squadron commander.
No, I'm not. I just want him to know I was here. Well, you can come back another time and let him know.
Dr. Dick said,
as he began tending to the airman lying on the bed in front of him. The wounded airman was wrapped up from head to toe, and his body was unresponsive. Out of curiosity, the boss whispered,
"Hey, is he gonna be all right?"
"This fella here? There's no need to whisper, Captain. He's brain dead. He took a bullet to the back of the head on that mission to Brunswick. What a shit show that was, yeah? Anyways, he's got third-degree burns all over his body, his kidneys are shutting down, and here's the kicker. He's allergic to the medication we gave him, so, yeah, doesn't look good. We're giving him a few days' worth of morphine until he goes. It's not my choice to waste the morphine, but, you know, these nurses, they insisted." The boss, in a state of shock, watches the doctor turn around and beginning heading towards the door to exit the wing of the hospital. Looking back down at the wounded airman, he was horrified to see that the gunner had a tear running down his cheek and his lip was quivering. With fire now filling his eyes, the boss marched his way down the hospital corridor of beds and entered into the hallway where he saw Dr. Dick standing talking to another nurse.
"Hey!"
yelled the boss. The entire hallway stopped and stared at the enraged boss approaching them.
"Captain, shut the fuck up! If I ever see or hear you being that insensitive to another wounded airman, I don't care if he's missing half his body or has a goddamn paper cut. I will see to it that you never see the inside of a hospital again as a doctor. Do you understand me? Is that clear?"
At this moment, Dr. Dick took a step backwards, and that's when the boss saw a crowd of people hovering around him. Realizing how much of a scene he just caused, the boss fled the hospital, leaving behind a stunned and shocked hospital staff.
Thank you for listening to episode 3 of season 2 of Snafu, a historical fiction podcast depicting the average life of a bomber crew in World War II. If you would like more information about the podcast, please visit our website and our Patreon page. Both links are down in the show notes. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned next week for episode 4 of season 2 of Snafu.